versus McKissick.
Please, the court, your honors, I am Morris Rosenberg. I'm the attorney for the appellants, Simona Vuletic and Michael Helgeson, husband and wife. This is the case where...
Do you want to reserve any time
for rebuttal? I'm sorry. Pardon me, your honor. I would like 7 minutes with 3 minutes reserved.
Very well.
This is the case where the deputy sheriff initially filed a return of service that was valid on its face, and subsequently filed an affidavit secured by the defense in the case that indicated he actually asked the young woman who was there at the time if she resided there, and she said no. So those two affidavits by the deputy sheriff are in direct contravention of each other.
Who bears that risk? the initial affidavit was different from the subsequent.
Well, the affidavit is prima facie proof of valid service, and that can be overcome by evidence presented by the served party. And in this case, the question is whether it's overcome or not. That's one of the three bases, anyhow, in the appeal. And there's three areas in the appeal that I believe justify the court, without doing any disservice to the jurisprudence of this state, to allow the case to proceed to a jury trial. The first is that service was sufficient within the meaning of our service statutes. The second, and the one I would intend to spend most of my time on, is the waiver argument. And the third is the issue of whether or not the trial court should have stricken the affirmative defense of insufficiency of service based upon the failure of the defense in the court below to respond to interrogatories, one of which specifically asked about affirmative defenses. Briefly on service, I think there's two bases to uphold the service. One is that, similar to Brown v. Edwards, where a neighbor was served who had the name Shirley, just like the defendant, and that Shirley delivered the papers to the defendant Shirley, who was a neighbor, and later filed an affidavit saying she had done that, that was held to be service. I mean, essentially, that's an affidavit of service. And in this case, the sworn testimony of the nanny is that she took the papers from the deputy sheriff, put them on the counter. When Mr. McKissick, the defendant, the respondent in this court, came downstairs, she told him where they were, and he picked them up and walked off with them. He confirmed that in his sworn testimony, that he picked them up. He expected them because he had been forewarned, either by defense counsel or his insurance company, that he would be served. Put those sworn statements together, I submit that it's like the Brown case.
It's undisputed the nanny did not live at the residence, right?
Well, she did not live there in the sense of spending the nights there. She spent the night there occasionally looking after the children. I would suggest that she's basically a substitute parent for these children. She was there, the record will reflect, 6 hours a day on Monday through Friday, taking care of three children, then one went off. One of the two children that remained was a challenged child who she was responsible for.
The statute talks in terms of resident therein, so why does what you just said qualify for that portion of the statute?
It would qualify if the court, similar to the faded case where the court said for the purposes of those service events, the person had two residences. She had moved to Chicago 8 months before. That was sufficient. And Justice Talmadge said this opens the floodgates because it's not, basically the term I would use is it's no longer perfect compliance, it's substantial compliance. And this young woman's contacts with that house and that family were more than, for instance, Wickard v. Cardwell, where the Supreme Court upheld service on a stepdaughter who happened to be spending the night there. She did not live there. She happened to be spending the night there. She's not a blood relative. And our Supreme Court said, basically really stretched the meaning of residence, that for that moment she was a resident therein. And I would say you do no disservice and do not open the floodgates based on this nanny's context.
So if I understand you clearly, you believe resident therein is met here by virtue of the fact that she's a nanny, and what other additional facts?
By virtue of the fact that she's there 6 hours every day, she's there more than during the day, she's there more than Mr. McKissick was there because he goes off to work. But I don't have a case directly on point on that. It requires an analysis similar to what was done in Fadig, and again, would do no disservice. The waiver argument, I believe, is virtually a compelling one, and I would simply point out that it looks like both sides, we have 11 waiver cases, several from the Supreme Court, four from this court, and some from the other divisions. I think all Division III, the others. Of those 11, six found waiver, five found no waiver. And the common theme that runs through those is the plaintiff put on some notice by the defense that there's an issue concerning service? Three cases came out of this court where there was no waiver. This court held no waiver. And those all involved a situation where the plaintiff was put on notice in time prior to the running of the statute, prior to the 90-day relation back period under the statute, to have an opportunity to react and do something. One of those cases, Streeter Dibadal, if I'm saying that right, versus Hoon, was a case I inadvertently failed to comment on in my briefing in this court, but did comment on it in the briefing in the trial court. And I meant no slight to you, Judge Gross. It was your case and it was your opinion. And you upheld, the service was bad because it was on a woman when the defendant was a man and it was not her place of residence. But on the issue of waiver, you found that the plaintiff was put on notice that there was an issue of waiver. I think the defense counsel early on, well before the statute ran, asked for a copy of the affidavit of service. Case law, Liebert and Butler versus Joy, mentioned the fact that the defense is on notice when there is the affidavit of service on file and in the record. So it's no defense to say we didn't know until 3 weeks after the statute had run.
You can use your rebuttal time if you want. It's up to you.
I'll save the rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, Levi Bendeley, defending Daryl McKissick, the respondent here. We're here today because a deputy sheriff was hired to effectuate service on behalf of the plaintiff. He went to the home of the defendant, was told that the defendant was upstairs taking a shower, asked the nanny downstairs, "Do you live here?" She told him no. Rather than waiting for Mr. McKissick to come downstairs, rather than asking for him to come downstairs, he hands her the papers, knowing that that's not proper service, knowing that she doesn't live there, asks her to give him the papers, and walks away. He's 2 months away from retirement, and who knows why he did this? Who knows why he filed a certificate of service that says, "I couldn't find Daryl McKissick, and I handed it to somebody who was then resident therein." Complete falsification. Who knows why he did it? What we do know is that plaintiff's counsel and defense counsel were taken in by this. It's an unfortunate situation. I've never seen it happen before. We both relied on that in good faith, dealt with each other very, cooperatively, issued really rote standard interrogatories to each other, and then find out later that this had happened. It's an unfortunate event.
Is the client's knowledge that the nanny is not a resident therein imputed to the attorney, to you?
I don't believe it's imputed, no. What is required at at this point, and I think the question was raised earlier, the first question was, whose burden of proof? Who's got the duty here? Case law throughout, every case I've ever seen, Tegeland, everyone says the burden is on the plaintiff. It would be a shift of that burden to do as you suggest and say there's some sort of imputed knowledge and that the defense has the duty to have some sort of imputed knowledge and tell the plaintiff that there's a problem with service. No case anywhere comes close to saying that. The burden has always rested with the plaintiff, never with the defendant. And that's what that would do if there was some sort of imputed knowledge. It would shift the burden. And it's just never been that way. Let's start off talking about the substitute service.
The issue for me appears to be resident therein.
Great.
Tell me about that.
We've got one case that's close, the Weichert case. That's where you have the defendant's adult daughter. She was there overnight, and she was the sole occupant of the residence. There's another case that followed it, the Saltz case. We'll talk about that in a second. But it said Weichert, when it analyzed Weichert, was the outer boundary of substitute service and had three requirements. You had to have a relative. The relative had to have possession of the house overnight, and they had to be the sole occupant. We don't have that here. We have Mr. McKissick upstairs. The nanny was not the sole occupant of the house. She wasn't a relative. She didn't spend the night. She spent two nights over the course of about 3 years when the mother was out of town. Otherwise, she lived with a boyfriend a few miles away, didn't receive mail there, didn't keep any clothes there, didn't have personal items there. She had a key to the house, and she went and took care of the kids during weekdays only. She's not a resident. The Saltz case is similar. That's the one where there was one neighbor caring for another neighbor's home. The defendant was away on vacation for 2 weeks. The neighbor was at the house watering some plants, and there was a knock on the door. She opened the door. The process server handed her papers. That was not effective service. It's a neighbor. It's not a relative. She didn't spend the night. She didn't have exclusive possession of the home. That's the distinction. The case that was brought up, I believe it was Brown. I might be have the wrong name, where one neighbor, Shirley, accepted service for another neighbor, Shirley. The process server went to the wrong house. They lived next to each other. Well, that neighbor who wasn't the defendant walked it over to the defendant, Shirley, handed her the papers. That's the critical distinction here. Drop service has never been validated by our courts. You can't drop the papers on a kitchen table. You can't drop them on a doorstep. You can't put them in the mailbox. Have to hand it to them in person. So in the Brown case, one Shirley was deemed to be an agent of the process server when she handed the papers to her neighbors. That's the distinction we have here with substitute service. We don't have any cases that allow it in under these facts. Waiver.
What happened between the nanny and Mr. McKissick and these papers?
Nanny took the papers, put them in the kitchen on the counter. Mr. McKissick came down from his shower later. I'm not sure at the time, but it was later that morning. And she said, "Sheriff came by. There are some papers for you in the kitchen." He went to the kitchen, picked up the papers, took them to his office. She did not hand him the papers. They did not discuss anything about the sheriff. She just said, "There's some papers for you on the table." So respondent's position, that's no different than him coming home, opening the front door, and finding papers sitting on his front stoop.
In various cases, say that service is made when the object of process opens the door, refuses to accept the papers. At that point, the laying of the papers on the sill is sufficient. If there wasn't, I've gotten to a point where I can't remember what I wrote.
Right.
I didn't write what I wrote and where I have it. I actually had that case, as a matter of fact. And I think that there is a case that validates that.
Perhaps.
I can't say I didn't get service by simply walking away from the deputy sheriff.
That didn't happen here. That's why we didn't brief it. That's why we didn't look for those cases.
I mean, the nanny says the papers are on the counter. We know that Mr. McKissick didn't pick up.
Maybe close. I think the distinction there is somebody refusing service. We have someone upstairs in the shower. All the sheriff had to do is say, "Could Mr. McKissick come downstairs?" Didn't ask. Could have waited outside for Mr. McKissick.
Step further if you say that.
I believe so. I believe by doing it, you go further than any case has before.
And you would rely on the language by the Supreme Court saying that the outer limits are defined by the case on which you rely?
Yes. Okay. Waiver. We'll be hearing a lot about that in reply. And I think it's probably the main issue here, more so than the substitute service. No Washington case has ever said that issuing discovery alone constitutes a waiver of the service requirement. There are cases that have gotten close, but no case has said issuing discovery alone is sufficient. What you have in Division I, Division II, and the Supreme Court, everything falls from the Liebert case. Liebert required a defendant to lie in wait. That's what Liebert's all about. And I agree with it. I'm not here to tell you that that's proper. If the defense here would have known, if the respondent would have had some inkling that the service was improper, well, sure, they had a duty to speak up and say something about it. That's not the case here. Everyone was deceived by the sheriff. What you have in Division III, there's one case that comes close. That's the Blankenship case. I'm sure you'll hear about that in a few seconds. Blankenship, I think, exceeds Liebert. It goes beyond what the Supreme Court allowed Division III to do. It shifts the burden to a defendant to notify a plaintiff if service is improper, and it doesn't really require lying in wait. And that's what Liebert was all about. What it does require, and what we don't have here, is a defendant who expends resources, and I think the quote is expenditures of time and money on discovery. In the Blankenship case, not only were interrogatories issued, there was a deposition of the plaintiff. Someone out to the plaintiff went to the plaintiff's house where the scene of the accident occurred and took photos. Went beyond issuing standard discovery. Actually noted up a deposition. That didn't happen here. What happened here is what happens in just about every case of this magnitude and this type in the state. Interrogatories, a button gets pushed by a paralegal. Interrogatories go back and forth between parties. And that happens quickly because, you know, these cases should be resolved. We shouldn't take up court time dealing with them. Standard interrogatories get issued. Does not mean that someone has sat down, someone has figured out all the intricacies of the case, and is lying in wait and trying to take advantage of a plaintiff. That didn't happen here. That's what Liebert tells us we need to look for. The Blankenship case, even if you want to follow it, the Division III case, which I think exceeds Liebert, does also require something more. It requires taking of a deposition, requires a scene investigation, taking photographs. There's another case out of Division III as well. I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's the Romju case. In addition to issuing interrogatories, in that case, plaintiff's attorney sent a letter to defense counsel and said, haven't heard from you. I think our service of process is good. Let me know if you don't think that's the case. Defense counsel never got back to him, never said anything, knew that defense, that the service wasn't proper, pounced on him, filed a motion to dismiss after the statute run. That's improper. That's not allowed. That's not what happened here. Plaintiff has a duty to talk to their process server, to ask for an answer, to ask for discovery responses, especially when they choose to file a case so close to the statute of limitations. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
If it please the court, the closeness to the statute of limitations is a red herring here. This case was filed 65 days before the statute would run, and the Romji case was filed 24 days before, and the Blankenship case was filed, I believe, like 5 days before the statute of limitations. In both of those cases, the absence of a motion to compel or motion to compel an answer or to require answers to interrogatories, and in Liebert, the absence of the plaintiff so moving was of no significance to the court. Counsel below and here seems to say, well, we can come to court, we can appear, but we can ignore everything. They made a choice. They could have simply ignored the lawsuit if service was bad and challenged any default judgment later for lack of jurisdiction. They came to court. They then need to observe the rules and proceed by the rules. And I would mention that the rules and the ignoring of the rules comes up again in the motion to strike the effort to add to the record in this case, which the commissioner sent to this panel for resolution along with this case. So It's briefed, I believe, well. I'm not going to argue it, but it is another indicator of the fact that the rules, by the way the defendants play, do not apply to them. They can ignore them with impunity. The Raymond versus Fleming is the one case from this division, predates the three of you. It's a 1979 decision that held that the service issue was waived because the defense counsel delayed answering the complaint, did ask for more time, but did not answer the complaint timely, and then once the time had run, answered the complaint, raised the issue. Raymond v. Fleming was relied upon by Liebert in deciding that there was waiver. And Liebert talks about dilatory conduct or conduct that is inconsistent with pleading to raising the issue of affirmative of service issue. And in this case, I think the fact that it's called rote, that the discovery is called rote, supports our view that they write a letter saying, let's have medical stips, let's get these records, let's depose early, let's get this case into mediation and get it resolved. That is conduct that is inconsistent and, if not intentionally, does deceive the plaintiff, and they are on notice under Butler. The Butler case and the Liebert case do say you're on notice when those affidavits of service are filed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.